Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. The name Bill Siemering may not be a household word, but his work has certainly found its way into millions of households in this country and around the world. Bill helped launch NPR nearly half a century ago as a member of National Public Radio's founding board of directors and as NPR's first director of programming. He was among those who established the network's mission and goals, and he is given credit for helping develop NPR's All Things Considered, the most listened-to afternoon drive-time radio news program in the country. He helped put Terry Gross before a national broadcast audience. After some 20 years, he took his expertise international, and now his role is as president of a nonprofit called Developing Radio Partners. It's dedicated to bringing quality radio and journalism to developing countries. Bill Siemering joins us in studio. Bill, it's a great pleasure to have you with us.
Great pleasure to be with you, Dan.
You know, I want to talk a little history with you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
We're going back maybe more years than either one of us would care to go back, almost 50 years now, the early days of NPR. Give me some sense of what it was like getting that operation off the ground.
Well, this was the first time that there was the live interconnection for public radio. It grew out of the Public Broadcasting Act, you know, and before that was educational radio. Mm-hmm. And if you don't mind, just a short history leap back even further to the very beginning of broadcasting. I mean, it's 100 years this year, actually.
Wow, that's right.
Started at the University of Wisconsin as part of what they call the Wisconsin Idea, as a land-grant university. And a university president had said 10 years before radio was invented, I want to have the beneficence of the university in the home of every citizen. Mm-hmm. In the state. Well, that turned into the boundaries of the campus are the boundaries of the state. So all I'm saying is from the very beginning, there was a social concern of using radio for social good, if you will. Mm-hmm. And the very first broadcast was to farmers. Only 60% were literate in Wisconsin at that time. And so they were needing this agricultural information right away. Anyway, so it was educational radio. And the actual term for broadcasting came from agriculture. The original meaning is to scatter seeds,
sure,
which is my favorite metaphor, and we all like that, you
yeah.
know. And that's really what we're doing. We're scattering seeds now, ideas that people may pick up and be nourished by. Anyway, so coming back to your question, I'm sorry I digressed. So it was very important that we start this new venture with a clear sense of purpose. And so I was asked to write the purpose for it. And what I had in mind was to differentiate us from the educational radio that was a bit stuffy sometimes, from commercial radio that was very slick, and usually the voice of authority from New York, and from PBS, and to try to capture the essence of the times, and to capitalize on the unique strengths of radio as a sound medium, a storytelling medium, and to get out of the studio so you're not just having the sterile voice of the authority from New York. So those were the things I had in mind when I wrote the mission statement.
Was there a sense of competition? I mean, did you get into it thinking that we're going to be competing with these other entities out there, or there was just going to be a specific niche for this entity?
Yeah, I never thought of it as an alternative. Mm-hmm. Like people talk about Pacifica Radio as kind of an alternative, because I felt that I wanted it to be the very first broadcast record of the day's news. And that's why we started at 5 at that time.
And the farmers were up by then.
Right, but there were, you know, the network television news was 6:30 and PBS came on with 7. Kind of like you've heard the big guys, now we'll give you kind of the back of the book background on this. So that was my intention, was to do this. And I thought by speaking with, as I wrote in the mission statement, many voices in many dialects, we would have a varied audience. And by using sound to help tell the stories, it would be more engaging. And we would attract a large audience. So, of course, you can never foretell how things turn out. But my intention was that it would not be second rate, that it would be it would be a serious source of journalism.
Compare where we are today to where you wanted to be when you started.
Well, I think, of course, times change. Sure. And I could maybe just read a paragraph from the mission if you want
to
get an idea of what I had in mind. I said, National Public Radio will serve the individual. It will promote personal growth. It will regard the individual differences with respect and joy rather than derision and hate. It will celebrate the human experience as infinitely varied rather than vacuous medal. It will encourage an active sense of constructive participation rather than apathetic helplessness. And then in describing what became All Things Considered, I wrote that it would it would not substitute superficial blindness for genuine diversity of regions, values, and cultural and ethnic minorities which comprise American society. It would speak with many voices and many dialects. The editorial attitude would be that of inquiry, curiosity, concern for the quality of life, critical, problem-solving, and life-loving. The listener should come to rely upon it as a source of information of consequence, of having listened has made a difference in their attitude toward the environment and themselves. So I put a lot of emphasis on diversity and respect, you know, and so those were some of the qualities, the kind of core principles that I believed in.
Are you pretty satisfied with where it is today and how it's abiding by those original principles?
Yeah, I think it is. And I think now with podcasts and other platforms that many of these things that were originally on All Things Considered are more varied. As the name suggests, we really want to consider more than just hard news. We want to include the cultural life of America, where ideas really come into society. You know, they're not. You don't look to Congress for news. I mean, that's old, really.
Hmm. Who was funding the operation back in the day?
It was the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and that was started in 1967, the Public Broadcasting Act. And so they had a mandate to provide a network service for the stations. And so this was the expectation that we could have a live, for the first time, all the educational radio stations would now be public, called public, and have a live interconnection. So that was the goal.
This was the days of Lyndon Johnson, of course. The times have changed.
Yes.
And the Corporation for Public Broadcasting Support for Public Radio may not be as generous or forthcoming as it has been
right.
in the past.
Right.
Yeah. Your thoughts about that?
Well, it's just so important to have this service, which is non-commercial.
Yeah.
It's not dependent upon corporate ratings or something like that. So I think it. In fact, I had said that it, in the mission again, if I might, that listeners feel that the time spent with NPR is among their most rewarding in media contact. NPR will not regard its audience as a market or in terms of its disposable income, but as curious, complex individuals who are looking for some understanding, meaning, and joy in the human experience. Yeah. So we're trying to differentiate it from the commercial, and we're certainly not state broadcasting by any means. You know, we're totally independent. I think more and more people are appreciating the value of that independent voice.
One of the things that always strikes me about NPR and what we do here is the fact that we give so much more time to stories. That just doesn't happen elsewhere, and
That's
it's so
right.
important in today's world.
Yes.
Time and context. What time of the day did All Things Considered air originally?
It aired at 5 Eastern time.
Okay.
Yeah.
What other programs were there in the earliest days? What other types of programs?
On NPR?
Yeah.
Well, we did have some radio drama that we would distribute by tape because we were using telephone lines to connect the stations. Yeah. There was a music, some classical music service, But in the very beginning, it was just All Things Considered. We had a very small staff. We had one studio. And but it branched out into more cultural programming as well.
When did that happen? When did that start to evolve? When did things like Morning Edition, for instance,
Morning Edition came in about 1980, I believe.
Well, it was that late.
Yeah.
I didn't realize it. Did you have anything to do with that?
No.
Yeah. No. It's a great program.
Yeah, it is.
It is a great program. When you think back to those early days, what were some of the challenges that you faced in terms of just getting this thing rolling?
Right. Well, we had a very small staff, as
I say.
It was an ambitious.
Yeah.
We had never done it before, so we were all learning as we go along. So, and I had initially envisioned that about a third of this programming would come from the station, so we'd have the country hearing itself, if you will, that. Mm-hmm. The stations would not just be a passive transmitter, but an active producer for the network. That never happened. Mm. We got many contributions from stations over time, but in the beginning there was no NPR style as we know it, and so the pieces that would come in weren't all that great. Sometimes the shelf was pretty bare. We were putting things on the air that we really didn't want to. Sometimes some of the other challenges were. From some of the stations, about 2 weeks after we went on air, we had the first public radio conference. And I think many of the station managers thought, we'll sound like CBS. We'll be like the big guys now. Mm-hmm. And it didn't sound like that.
No.
And so they would say, they were uncomfortable with it. They said, well, you're using music as editorial or... And I had a few that objected to women's voices, actually. They said, women's voices, Bill, you should see the meter, the high frequencies on FM. And then some would say, well, women can do the soft features, but really they don't have the authority to do the hard news. Of course, I ignored all that.
Sure. Some of those women are still around, aren't they?
They are. Linda Wertheimer, for one.
I was just going to mention her. She was on this program not too awfully long ago.
Uh-huh.
And we talked about it, and I said, why did the women of that day, they were so prominent and so talented, how did all of that come into being? She said they just felt they'd get more bang for their buck. Does that sound right to you?
No, I never thought it that way. I thought they were the brightest people I could find. I never gave it second thought about hiring women.
Did you have any trouble attracting talent to this new kind of vehicle?
Well, it was interesting because they were – sometimes people would come in and say, I used to work in the Navy and public relations and I need a job. But what I always look for when I'm interviewing people is curiosity, I think, and a brightness and an authenticity. And Susan Sandberg, I think, has really epitomized that. She has a good air presence. Not everyone has air presence.
And tells a story so very, very well.
And she's the same off mic as she is on.
Yeah.
And I think I credit her with really giving the voice to NPR in the early days. And she was the first woman to host a national news program.
Women are so dominant on NPR. I mean, particularly in this whole news area, the hottest spots in the world are being manned, if you don't mind my saying, by women.
Right.
I mean, they're in the thick of it all and doing wonderful work as reporters.
Right. Yeah. And the producer, the executive producer of All Things Considered, is a woman of color.
Yeah. Are you surprised it's still there?
Oh, no.
I kind of thought that's the way you'd respond.
I mean, its audience is growing, which is wonderful.
Yeah, and the most listened to news program in afternoon drive time.
Uh-huh.
It's remarkable. I have to take a break. We're talking with Bill Semering, who is a gentleman who helped and to a very large degree was responsible for getting NPR off the ground almost half a century ago. We'll come back, continue our conversation. I'd like to talk to Bill about some of the things going on in the broadcast world today, not necessarily involving NPR. We'll do that when we come back. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Now back to our conversation with Bill Siemering. Bill, you're given a lot of credit for putting Terry Gross on the broadcast map. How did that come about?
Well, I was in Philadelphia, and she was doing a three-hour program called Fresh Air, pretty much by herself. She and Danny Miller, who had been an intern from Temple University.
Still there.
Yes, he's executive producer and a great friend. And so over time, you know, people would leave the studio and say to me, you know, that she's a really great interview. I said, yes, I know. So it came about that some of the staff at some of the stations in the East wanted to start All Things Considered at 4. And the staff was saying, you know, it's hard enough to meet the 5 o'clock deadline. So they weren't too keen on that. And I thought, you know, Fresh Air could be like the style section of a newspaper, the magazine section of a newspaper, the lead-in to All Things Considered. And so we did send out a weekly version of Fresh Air a little bit to get people familiar with it. And then it came so that I talked to Robert Siegel. He was news director at the time and suggested this. And he said, yeah, let's try this. So we designed Fresh Air to be a companion, to be seamless. So the longer interviews would be in the first half hour. Mm-hmm. Shorter features, it would be at the same pace as All Things Considered in the second half hour. And we even had a live promo with Robert. So Terry would say, so Robert, what do you have on ATC tonight? Mm. So it really was seamless, and it worked very well that way.
I guess it did. It's still going pretty strong,
yeah,
isn't it?
It has. It's. I think it's one of the most listened to podcasts also. Yeah.
And she certainly has an interesting and wonderful technique in terms of drawing people out and bringing out things that you know, the folks being interviewed probably never thought they'd ever be discussing on the radio.
Right.
She has that ability.
That's right.
And you saw that.
Yes, yes. Yeah. And she's like the master now on some of this. You know, she received the National Humanities Award from President Obama.
Yeah. It must make you very proud to see that how these programs and these personalities have endured over the years.
Well, they're the one that did the work. And I think, you know, as one gets older, you kind of look back and say, well, what – I think we all have different gifts, you know. Mm. And I think my gift has been to hire good people and to manage as I would like to be managed. Mm. It's that simple. And so I didn't do it. It's really the folks
well,
that I hired.
It's a collaboration.
Yeah. Okay.
I think we have concede that. I'd like to talk a little bit with you, Bill, about what's going on in the world of journalism today. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're all watching our new president and the attitude that he has taken toward media and the press in general. You've done work with journalists, obviously, and you've taught journalism and you've worked with international journalists. What do you make of this approach from the new president?
It's really tragic, I think, because to undermine the credibility of journalism is a great disservice to the country. I'm not talking about people I respect who voted for President Trump and those reasons they have and whatever policies, but the attack upon the media is really unprecedented. And to, during the campaign, use them as really part of his presentation as a tool, actually, to deride them, to call them liars into their face and get the audience involved. And then this recent one of saying that they're enemy of the people. It's a tragic thing because the public ignorance we have now in the country, people believing lies, and that's what they are. I don't like to even call it fake news because news is kind of sacred in a way. And I think journalists regard their work as being sacred, telling the truth, you know. And otherwise, it's contaminating the environment. It's like having polluted water in a community to have lies. So, you know, Adams had said, James Madison said, a popular government without popular information or the means of acquiring it is but a prologue to a farce or a tragedy, or perhaps both. Knowledge will forever govern ignorance, and a people who mean to be their own governors must arm themselves with a power which knowledge gives. That kind of summarizes the importance of what this is all about.
And I think of what Thomas Jefferson said, too. The greatest threat to a democracy is an ill-informed electorate.
Right.
And that's
right.
Kind
and they're
of
ill-informed
dangerous
now. Yeah. I mean, to cite an example, I'm quoting this from the New York Daily News article that said, you recall when Kellyanne Conway had said that we made a reference to the Bowling Green massacre.
Right.
And the next week, a survey found that 51% of the Republicans felt that the Bowling Green massacre was just one of the reasons to have the ban on immigrants. Sure. And it's all fiction, 100% fiction. So if people are making judgments about fiction, it's we can't run that way.
I wonder if I'm not sure this is the correct way to put it, but I wonder if all of this isn't kind of awakening a sleeping giant, that being the media, that I think might get some more resolve in terms of looking more closely at what's going on and what's being said, and certainly watching this administration more closely than it might have otherwise.
Yes, and it's a challenge to keep up with all the misinformation and lies, really, that come from various people. And when you discredit the responsible journalists in the country, then when they're telling the truth as they are, they're not believed by the people that believe Mr. Trump, who says that they're liars.
And we've been down this road before, Bill. I mean, you and I are old enough to remember an era bygone that led ultimately to World War II, in which tactics such as these were used. I mean, it's a strong thing to say, I know, but a lot of people are saying it. This is mindful of a very serious time in history.
It is. I mean, public ignorance is a serious challenge to our democracy. Mm. That and gerrymandering, I would say.
That's a whole other subject.
Yes, I know.
Well, are you fearful that this will continue, or do you see that that, as I indicated, we'll waken this sleeping giant?
Yeah, I think the knowledge will overcome ignorance, as James Madison said, in the long run.
All right. Well, we'll have to watch and see how it plays out. There was a different president who went before the nation and Congress last night. Mm-hmm. Different tone, and I think people are hoping that will persist.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Let's talk about what you're doing now. I mean, you've gone into – you've left NPR, 20-some-odd years
ago? Oh, wait.
You were there with NPR for 20 years.
No, I was only there 2 years.
Oh, you were?
Yeah.
Well, how do I have that wrong? I had it's 20 years. Whatever.
Then I went out to Minnesota Public Radio, and then I went to – yeah.
But you were with Public Radio
for
20 years.
Radio.
Okay,
yeah,
okay.
Right.
But tell us what you're doing now. I mean, the Developing Radio Partners is the new organization. What's that all about?
All right. Developing Radio Partners grew out of some work I was doing overseas with the Open Society Foundation for 10 years. In that case, it was trying to give tools to new democracies after the breakup of the Soviet bloc and also in Africa and Mongolia and so on. So I was working with them and realized the importance of radio and development. It's the most important tool, most important means of communication for Africans. And so what we do, we work with local community radio stations to enrich their programming about the most important topics of development, namely climate smart agriculture, health, women's health, reproductive health, and youth primarily. And so we give them information and tools so they can do that. We have an initial workshop where a scientist will explain the topic. We send them weekly bulletins which originate from that country about a statement of a problem and on the other side solutions and production tips. And we give them money for community activities. We have a in-country trainer that speaks local languages that can visit the stations and improve skills. So it's very grassroots. It's not the North Whitey coming in and imposing mm-hmm. something. We're empowering them, and they take ownership of the project. They say it's our project.
What is radio's reach like in that part of the world?
80% of the people rely on radio. And so the challenge in development is often what they call the last mile. How do you get the information to the hardest to reach? And radio is the way to do that.
You know, given some of the countries that we might be talking about, I wonder what sort of protections are there from your point of view to keep that from being abused? If you can reach so many people via radio, to make sure that the right people are reaching the people, if you follow me. Because there's a lot going on in Africa, obviously.
Right. So the local stations, generally, there may be like 100-watt stations that get out about 25 kilometers, which is about what you need for a trading center to reach the farmers. And so they're independent, and they're independent of government. Now, we do an assessment of the stations we work with to make sure they aren't having some special interest or just playing music, that they're doing some serious development programming. And so they're reliable stations, and we have a weekly reporting back of what they're doing on the programming. Mm-hmm. They send us the program, so we know they're not goofing off with it.
What I'm thinking of is if there is political upheaval of the potential for it in any of these countries, that the first thing that the people who would want to take over, for instance, would go for is the radio station.
Yeah, but they don't – we're working – I mean, that's part of the selection of the countries we work in. So there has to be an enabling environment. There's a degree of freedom of press, and they also have their state radios as a rule too.
How many countries are you in?
Well, we're now working in Rwanda, Cameroon, Zambia, Malawi, Cape Verde, and we'll be adding to that before long.
Yeah. And other parts of the world? Is it just Africa?
We're focusing right now on Africa. We're very open to expanding to other continents as well.
Mm-hmm. We've got a couple of minutes left, and we have a call or two that I'm going to try to bring in as time allows. We'll begin with Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, time's a-wasting, though. If you'd make it quick, please.
Well, good afternoon. I just wanted to say I was I really liked your comment about curiosity being a characteristic that you look for, because I've always considered that to be probably the most underrated human characteristic. And I've always had a slight distrust of people who seem to be incurious about the world around them. So that is a great attribute to look for, and you're on a great station. Thank you.
Yes, curiosity is important because they come up with story ideas because they walk into work and they see something. And they will pursue the story to its very end. They're not satisfied till they get all the facts.
Yeah. In the operations in Africa, are young people involved?
Very much so. Very much so. And the majority of Africans are under 25. And we have special training for youth, as a matter of fact, to empower them to be on air.
And how are they equipped in today's digital world to deal with it?
Yeah, they're very good with mobile phones, but they're not always connected to internet. But they are when they are, they're often on Facebook.
It's everywhere.
Yeah.
Facebook is everywhere. Bringing it back to this country, you know, one of the big challenges faced by public radio today is to develop a younger audience so that it has a future audience.
Right. Go ahead.
I was going to ask if you had any ideas as to how's the best way to do that.
How to
attract that younger audience?
Well, when you've got the youth producing, you know, they like to listen to that. People can check our Facebook page with Developing Radio, Dev Radio Partners, and see some of the work and accomplishments.
What might some of those be?
Well, how farmers are learning new techniques of water storage, or conservation farming, or sometimes it's a better stove that's been used, something like that.
So in a sense, what you're doing now goes back to the roots of public radio in this country.
Exactly. It goes back exactly there. And because we're working in Zambia with the meteorological department to improve the weather forecasting for farmers. And it's exactly the same as what radio was first used for 100 years ago.
So the more things change, the more they stay the same,
yes.
Right? Right. Bill, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Bill Seemring has been our guest.
Pleasure to be with you.
President of Developing Radio Partners, one of the founding directors of National Public Radio. Bill will be speaking tomorrow evening at 7:30 at Principia College. We'll have details on that on our website. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.